Thank you all for coming on a hot summer morning. I honestly didn't think when we put this together that there'd be this kind of interest, but I guess it has more to do with the crisis, the severity of the crisis in Turkey than my ability to describe it. Or, with all respect, Ambassador Paris is certainly defer to him on that. I'd like to thank Ambassador Paris for agreeing to participate in today's meeting. He was ambassador in Turkey between 1997 and 2000. The dates are relevant because that's the period immediately after the undemocratic overthrow of the government, the last time that that happened in Turkey. And that's precisely what we're discussing today. Now, he's been following events in Turkey since then, currently as a visiting fellow at Brookings. And just as importantly, he's just come back from a brief trip to Turkey, so I'm eager to hear his observations. Now, before then, I will provide a snapshot, frankly no more than that, of the crisis, because my colleague, Sedat Çiftçi, who is a research associate with the CSIS Turkey project, and I put together an update, a commentary, which is in front of you, in which we try to detail what was going on, so I will not get bogged down in those details. But I'm going to look at the big picture briefly. And what's the big picture? Well, the big picture is, yes, indeed, there is a crisis. In fact, we may have two crises occurring simultaneously. But let's begin with the first one, the possible closure of the ruling party. Although 24 parties have been closed down in Turkey, and although four occasions the ruling parties have been forced out of office in undemocratic manner, 1960, 71, 1980, and of course 1997, this is the first time that a ruling party is facing closure through judicial means in office, and that's unprecedented. Now, is it a judicial coup? An expression that no doubt you heard many times when you were in Turkey. Certainly it's been all over the Turkish press, and many people in Turkey, particularly the JDP supporters, believe that this is a judicial coup. And trace its lineage back through the 97 postmodern coup, as it was called, through the earlier coups, in which the TGS, directly or indirectly, in one form or another, pushed out the ruling party, acting in the name of the interests of the state. And that's why the second crisis, the recent arrests, which was the sixth wave in the so-called Ergenekon, the catch-all title Ergenekon conspiracy that's been talked about, is so important, because it included two generals, two ex-generals, one former head of the gendarmerie, Şener Ergür, and the former head of the Aegean Army, Hürşit Tolan, is so important. Although the two generals were not named in the indictment, which was unveiled yesterday against 86 individuals, the very fact that they were picked up, coupled with the stories that's, again, all over the Turkish press, all their involvement or alleged involvement in early coup attempts, and perhaps even the current one that's being investigated, is unprecedented. Now, Turkey's had four coups, as I said, in the past, but the only time that any officers were tried, convicted, and in this particular case, in one case, hanged, in the one case that hanged, was in 1963. Talat Aydemir and an associate were hanged after two unsuccessful coups against the government, and the man who signed the death warrant was Cemal Gürsel, who became president of Turkey after the 1960 coup. So we're again in uncharted waters. The possible trial of the two ex-generals is would be a major event. It would have been a major event any time if it happens, but the fact that it's occurring at this particular moment when the ruling party is facing closure escalates the crisis. And it gets us into the broader issue, which I'm sure we will go into, both with Ambassador Paris and the Q&A, of civilian-military relations in Turkey. So we all have our views on the crisis. Let me try and define it. It's very difficult to look at an issue that everybody's been talking about and writing about and come up with any original ideas, so I won't claim any kind of originality in the way I look at it. But it is, in essence, the latest stage in a very difficult adjustment of a rigidly secular system to a democratically elected government which has its roots in the Islamist movement. To be sure, the current government is also not as sensitive to secularism as previous governments, and it does reflect the growing religiosity to a greater extent than earlier governments. The system has adjusted. The rigidly secular system has adjusted. But it's done so in an ad hoc manner. The most recent example was the adjustment to the election of Abdullah Gül as president to go up to the palace where he could not take his wife with an Islamic headscarf to receptions before. That's an adjustment. But I would argue that we've reached a point now where the system, and we can discuss what the system is, will either have to accept living with the JDP or its like-minded successor if it's closed down, or continue to resist with all its consequences. In other words, we're finding the limits of democracy as it's applied in Turkey. Now, ideally, the JDP, the ruling party, and its ideas and actions should be defeated at the ballot box. But through the current closure case and the alleged conspiracy, it's been challenged in extra-parliamentary ways. Now, can the JDP falter? Of course. Failed to go for a broader consensus after the July elections in the way that Tayyip Erdogan suggested with a speech immediately after the elections. It can be faulted for pushing ahead with the election of Abdullah Gül instead of another candidate who was less controversial. And it could be faulted for acting after 5 years of being very cautious on this issue, on the symbolically important and neuralgic Islamic headscarf issue. But at a broader level, what we're talking about is resistance to its subjective rejection of the label of Islamist by opponents who are willing to try to define it objectively. So the AK Party has said from the beginning, the JDP, that it rejects the label of Islamist, including at a meeting here at CSIS that some of you may have attended back in January 2002 before the election. He said, we're not a continuation of the four Islamist parties that were closed down. We're a different party. Nonetheless, the subjective definition, rejection of the label, is being challenged objectively. If you want to see how it's being done in a very comprehensive manner, just look at the prosecution case made by Yalçın Kaya. Now, the JDP and its supporters, as we said in the commentary, are seething. They're very angry at what's being done in less than a year after the elections. However, Tayyip Erdogan has fashioned a strategy that's noteworthy, not for what it's doing, not just for what it's doing, but also what it's refrained from doing. One, no constitutional changes to make party closure more difficult. And that was speculated about quite a bit. No early elections. He had the option of going for early elections immediately and confirming the mandate. He didn't do that. No mass demonstrations by his supporters. One prominent member of the ruling party came to a meeting we had here in which he said that that was an option that was discussed but specifically rejected. Instead, Erdogan has continued to follow a strategy in which he stresses how it's business as usual, or at least as much as possible, that, you know, it's effective in domestic politics, that, you know, it's effective in foreign affairs and the economy, and that's trying to underline the costs, the possible costs of closure and the instability that would result if its opponents were successful. It's also mounted a vigorous defense. I mean, I have the text of the very long defense in front of me, in which it emphasizes the concept of democratic secularism, and does so in a very interesting way. And what it's saying, and we can get into this in the Q&A if you want, that it's saying, I'm happy to adjust, I'm happy to live with a secular system, but the secular system needs to be adjusted to the dictates of the democratic process. Now, this current struggle, as we all know, goes all the way back to the creation of the modern republic. The Kemalist Revolution, which created Turkey, identified religious fundamentalism as an obstacle to Turkey's integration into the Western system. Between 1923 and 1950, in the one-party system. It was very vigorous in its defense of it. And then subsequently, we don't have time to go into it, in every one of the coups, particularly in 60, 80, to some extent, and certainly 1997, opposition to religious fundamentalism was a factor. Now, the Constitutional Court Vice Chair Osman Paksit, whom we quoted in the commentaries, right? Whatever the way the verdict goes, whichever the way it goes, there'll be trouble. If it's closed down, or even if it's not. One of the problems for Tayyip Erdogan's opponents, which is going to come to the fore over the period when the decision is made, and it could be in the next 3-4 weeks, or it could be later. Nobody knows. You talk to 3 people in Ankara, you get 3 different views. If you talk to 10, you get 10 different views. Erdogan and the JDP are very difficult opponents for those who dislike them. Not least because I think Erdogan has learned from the experiences of Erbakan, the Erbakan-led government in 1997. That was domestically inept, was out of tune with international dynamics, and therefore a relatively easy victim. Instead, as I said, the JDP is demonstrating mastery of the domestic situation, and through its pursuit of EU membership, a willingness to try and work with the US in spite of the difficulties in 2003, and its willingness to continue the integration of Turkey in the global economy, it's showing deftness in international affairs, which leads to the kind of commentary that we've seen. For example, in the Financial Times, Turkey's secular coup must crumble. That was about a week ago. And today, the Financial Times has a similar article saying more or less the same thing. It's also demonstrated a remarkable internal cohesion, in contrast to its Islamist predecessors, as well as other ruling parties, which were faced with this kind of pressure. There's been no significant resignation from the party, although within the past few days, former Deputy Prime Minister Abdul Latif Şener has set up a new movement after not agreeing to run in the last elections. But there's been no major split from this party, and that's very significant. And Tayyip Erdogan, significantly the other day, said anybody who gets off this train cannot get back on. For the moment, its opponents have to recognize that this party is not crumbling under pressure. The question is, what will happen if and when it's closed down? Of course, it needs to be said, the ruling party has benefited from the inept and frankly ineffective opposition by its main opponents in the political system. The Republican People's Party has been oscillating between the social democratic line that it followed very successfully under Ecevit 3 decades ago to opposition to Erdogan's foreign policies bordering on xenophobia. It's very difficult to actually put a finger on exactly what the RPP policy is. Remarkably, the National Action Party, MHP, to use this Turkish acronym, under Devlet Bahçeli, has also failed to capitalize on the undoubted national surge in Turkey. In short, Tayyip Erdogan and the JDP may have found a very successful formula. The most charismatic leader by far, the best party organization, again by far, a populist touch which taps into the growing religiosity of the Turkish people and a willingness to understand and to cater, wrong word, but to allow that growing religiosity to be expressed in a visible manner. And not least, an ability to control the news cycle and to counter any media campaign against it, which is very impressive, although one can argue about the way it's being done. As a son of a journalist, I'm somewhat disturbed about the way in which this government, like earlier governments, has tried to control the news cycle, but you've got to admit that the JDP has done a very good job of it. And, as I said, an ability to be in tune with international dynamics. Now, given the composition of the court, 8 of the 11 members having been appointed by Ahmed Nejdet Sezer, and given its decision on the turban, the Islamic headscarf legislation, it's difficult to be optimistic if you're a JDP supporter. Now, I know people have argued that it's now less likely that the party is going to be closed down, but my view with it is that it's more likely that it will be closed down than not. So in the short run, the JDP and Erdogan may not win. But in the medium run, I think that its opponents cannot win because Tayyip Erdogan and the JDP or the JDP's successors will almost certainly win the next elections if you look at the opinion polls and if you look at the weakness of its opponents. The big question out there, and we can get into this in the Q&A, is whether Tayyip Erdogan will be able to lead his party or his successor. The by-election formula that we go into in the commentary, where he would run in by-elections and come back and lead as an independent, the successor party, JDP, may not be an option he could follow. So maybe early elections where he would head a new party would be another alternative. What about the long run? I mean, with that, I bring it to my presentation to a conclusion. Well, it's difficult to be optimistic. Turkey is becoming increasingly polarized. And the polarization, which you see very quickly after you land in Istanbul or in Ankara, is between those who want unfettered democracy, whatever its implications for the secular state as was originally designed, and those who see the JDP as the manifestation of the counter-revolution against the Kemalist ideas, reforms, and the state that it bequeathed. How things will turn out, of course, will depend to some extent on the JDP, but I think even to an even greater extent on the attitude of the TGS. As I said, the TGS, the Turkish General Staff, has been a permanent factor in the political developments in Turkey, including involvement in the four coups that Turkey has witnessed. After the JDP victory in 2002, it was the opposition of then Chief of Staff Hilmi Özkök to the apparently expressed desires of his force commanders for a coup that held the line. In 2007, it may have been the unwillingness of current Chief of Staff Yaşar Büyükanıt to allow the escalation of the conflict over the presidency to go beyond a certain point that may have saved Turkey. Now it'll depend on İlker Başbuğ, who seems set to take over as Chief of Staff in a few weeks. Now the ultimate question is whether the TGS has evolved its position to the point of being given being ready to give up its role as the ultimate guardian of the Turkish state, whatever the consequences. This will be shown not only by how it reacts to the verdict of the Constitutional Court, but also to how it will react to the unprecedented trial of two top commanders, ex-commanders, which may be coming up in the next few weeks or next few months. Anyway, with that, I will stop and kick the ball to Ambassador Paris.
Thank you, Bülent. A year ago, we sat right here and commented on the Turkish elections of July 22nd. And I think what's different between then and now is that then we were dealing with something that had happened. It was sort of definitive. There was a conclusion. We could talk about it. In baseball terms, it was sort of like being in the top of the ninth with one of the teams ahead on runs. And it was pretty clear how it was going to end. The only question was how they were going to handle the presidency. But at least there was a there that you could kind of grab onto and wrestle with. This is a much more difficult topic to address, I have to say. Let me commend the paper that you and your team have done as sort of a very good job of sort of laying out the facts, as did your presentation. My own presentation is going to be probably not as well organized, much more impressionistic, partly as a function of jet lag, which I haven't quite got over yet, but also because you just hear so many different takes on this in Turkey in a short visit like the one I just had, that I think all I can really do is sort of share them with you, and then we can sort of tease them apart in the Q&A. Let me as well sort of step back to set the frame of reference for what I want to talk about. And I agree basically with the way you described the crisis. As I was approaching this, the question I asked myself is, why are we having this conversation about what's going on in Turkey today? Why is Turkey having this discussion about what's going on in Turkey today? And I think the simple fact is that the reason that this conversation, that this phenomenon we're discussing is taking place, is that if it is impossible at this point to conceive that in any fair election in Turkey, as far ahead as anybody can see, any party but AKP can win. That is, to some degree, a statement about the opposition. It is, to some extent, a statement about the objective circumstances, but it's fundamentally a statement about AKP for a lot of the reasons that you mentioned. This is a party that, in terms of organization, in terms of managing the tools of modern campaigning, in terms of the personalities that they bring to the table, they are simply in a class by themselves, whether you like it or you don't like it. I think that has to be the point of departure of any discussion here, because the corollary is that after July 22nd of last year, you were looking at a situation that if AKP had done the right things, they probably could have locked in hegemony of the Turkish political situation for a generation. What are the right things? The right things are some of the things that Bulent mentioned. Restarting the European Union process, doing repair work or renovation of the Turkish constitution, which everybody agreed is outmoded. Moderating some of the sharper edges of what some secretly believe to be the Islamic agenda, being a government of all Turkey, as the Prime Minister had promised. That didn't happen. And I think the irony is that the sort of rainbow coalition that AKP was able to put together for the July 22nd victory was beginning to unravel last fall and over the winter, and could very well have led to a significant decline in AKP's support around the country if it had been allowed to continue. Some of the Turks that I know best who dislike AKP most are truly angry with the courts for having stopped that process and, in a sense, in their view, saved AKP from its own errors. Be that as it may, we're now in a situation. Polarization is perhaps a good word. It's a word that's being used a lot, but it seems to me that you can't just talk about Turkey being polarized. Too often the discussion in the Western media puts this in terms of Kemalists versus Islamists. I think most of the people in this room understand that it's much more complicated than that. But I was struck when I was there by what a wide range of actors have now gotten into this particular drama, many of whom simply were not actors in prior phenomena of this sort, such as the 1997 events. And I think it might be useful to sort of just take a walk through the park and sort of identify the actors and talk a little bit about what seem to be their assets and weaknesses going forward and what the implications of those may be. The first, obviously, is the AKP and its core base, and we both talked about the organizational skills and other skills that they bring to this process, not least of which is, as Bulent suggested, a high degree of international legitimacy. Condoleezza Rice's comments about the success that the Bush administration has had in working with the AKP leadership went pretty far. The fact of Erdogan treating with Olmert and Sarkozy and Maliki over the past week, I think, is clearly a message that this is a guy who's performing at the highest levels of world diplomacy. And does Turkey really want to sacrifice that seat at the table? The liabilities of the organization, of the prime minister, were on display last fall. in addition to the political errors that they've made, there's this notion of corruption working its way into the AKP portfolio. There have been real questions raised about their commitment to liberal democracy. But, you know, when you boil that down, all it says really is that they share the political culture of some of their predecessors, not that they are radically a different kind of party from some of those in the past. So that's AKP. Then you have what I'll call the liberals and Western-oriented elite, largely Istanbul, not exclusively. People who, to some degree in 2002 and to an extensive degree in 2007, backed AKP as the best hope for dealing with issues like liberal reform, economic reform, and dealing with the Kurdish problem. This group became very disenchanted with AKP last fall for the reasons we've discussed. And I think that they've been further disenchanted to some extent by the methods that have been used in the Ergenekon investigation, which are frankly frightening to some of them. And I would have characterized, when I was in Turkey in June, the attitude of many of them as something like the following. You know, we voted for Erdogan. We hoped he would be the guy that could change this country in the right direction. He hasn't. We'll never regain our trust for him. It's never a good thing to ban parties, but, you know, this is a case where we may simply have to go along with it. Sort of crocodile tears. I have the sense that in the last month, between my two visits, this has changed a little bit, and people are beginning to realize that maybe they can't afford the luxury of that approach. But in any case, the identity that was established for purposes of the July elections is pretty much no longer there, and I think it'll be difficult to reestablish trust between those two groups. Then you have the Kemalist deep state, you know, inside and outside of the formal state structure, not interested in a new improved Turkey, suspicious about the West, indifferent about foreign opinion, imbued with the spirit to some extent of sort of the worse the better. The madder Europe gets at us, the more Europe protests, the better it is. It just shows who our friends are and creates running room for this way of thinking. Some seem to have been willing to resort to violence. Some seem to have seen the need, perhaps based on the 97 experience, of a modicum of public support from other sectors of society. And the leak of alleged plans to destabilize society, to create support for extra-constitutional methods may have some significance in that respect. But this is essentially a group that has little to lose by radical measures, because the reform, to the extent that it can be reestablished on a viable basis, is a one-way ticket to their marginalization. Now it gets interesting, because you're beginning to see actors come onto the scene who I will describe as soldier statesmen. Hilmi Özkırk is the most obvious example of this, but if you look at the things that the top generals have said, they're often the most sensible things that have been said in recent weeks. I refer you to General Başbuğ's comments of a few weeks ago in that regard. But what this makes clear, and it's definitely through glass darkly, because we don't know what's going on within the military, but it suggests strongly that the institution is not a monolith, that there are shades of opinion, and that particularly among the retired military, you could see them playing a more active role as this process unwinds. General Özkırk, for example, has said he's prepared to give testimony in the Ergenekon trial. And I think what this, the practical impact of this on the politics is that it enables it those who would push back against attempts by the deep state to change the rules of the game against AKP's interests, and may demonstrate to them that they're not necessarily alone in doing so. Then there are what I will call third forces, for lack of a better term. And I'm using this as kind of a catch-all category to include those who are behind the Ergenekon investigation. And I'll be the first to admit I don't know who they are. But they clearly have significant resources within the police, police intelligence and other parts of the police. They have prosecutors who are willing to take these cases on. I don't know if they're acting on behalf of the Prime Minister. I don't know if they're acting, if the Prime Minister has been aware at all times as to what they are doing or what their intentions are. But I believe that they are united in seeking to ensure that the other side, that is the side seeking to bring the Prime Minister down, does not win. And I won't try to define it any more tightly than that. And then finally, also in the category of third forces, there is a lot of talk in the country today about recreating an alternative in the center of the political spectrum to AKP. The Abdelatif Shener defection from the party is part of this. Some of the things that Rifat Hisarçıklıoğlu has said and done seem to be in keeping with an attempt to create a new movement. I think virtually every used politician, that is former politician, unsuccessful politician in Turkey, is exploring how they would fit into something like this. And the assumption that they all seem to be sharing is that there will be a void that will be created by the closure of AKP, and this is perhaps a unique moment for a third party to fill it. Those of you who followed Turkey over the years have heard a lot of talk about this kind of thing. Whether this is a different case, time will tell. So those are my sense of the actors. Where is it going? I don't think it's going anywhere fast. I would say that the people who started this, and again, I'm not going to try to define that more precisely, are a little bit like Bush in 2004. They were clever enough to start something important, in this case to throw AKP and Recep Tayyip Erdogan seriously off balance. But they haven't been clever enough to finish it, and they haven't been clever enough to anticipate the unintended consequences. And those unintended consequences have created a situation where now, I think, where they look around, you've got almost a situation of what we used to refer to in terms of the old Soviet Union as mutual assured destruction, or MAD. It may very well be possible that the people behind this can take the Prime Minister down, close the party, but a lot of people could go down with them. A lot of people can get hurt if this process goes ahead. And so I think what you do in situations like that is you don't rush, you take your time, and I think all of the parties have an interest in this dragging out a bit longer. AKP, I think, wanted a quick resolution earlier, but I think that they sense now that time may be working in their favor as they've managed to even up the ground. I wouldn't be surprised to see President Gül become somewhat more active as this process takes place. I think the military does not want this issue to come to a head until they're past their own commander replacement process in August. I think the worst thing for the military would be any suggestion that the selection process would be tainted by some kind of a dirty political deal. So the way you do that is you put the outcome behind the actual decision-making, or at least try to. I think the liberals understand that an early decision is probably a bad decision from their standpoint, and therefore are not pressing for quite so quick an outcome. I think the Ergenekon prosecution needs time to get its case together. I think the new politicians, or would-be new politicians, need time to organize whatever it is they think they're trying to put together. And my sense is, you know, leading off Justice Paksut's comment, you know, the Constitutional Court itself is a bit intimidated by what they've gotten themselves into. And I'm saying that only based on their own remarks and without any desire to call into question their integrity, but they're dealing with some very big issues, and some of the things that they're saying reflect that. So my assumption is they will take the time that they think they need to get it right in whatever that may mean. I would look for something in mid-August, probably on a Friday evening. If you put it all together, I think it suggests that the odds that ways will be found to avoid a meltdown are better than they were a month ago and may be growing. I would agree with you, Bülent, that if I had to bet today, the safe bet would be that the party would be closed, and Turkey would live with the consequences. But I do feel that the calculus has shifted in subtle ways over the past month, and is moving towards a situation where you could have, I hesitate to say deal or compromise, because those are too firm in terms of what would likely occur. I think you're talking about something that would be implicit but understood in terms of what the various parties would have to do to make this thing work. And I want to say, one of the things you hear is that there'll be a solution where they will not ban AKP, but they will knock Erdogan out of politics. I don't think that is an option, as analytically. I think that the international reaction would be every bit as strong to that. I think that for all the reasons that Bulent described in terms of the way the party has hung together so far and the kind of party that it is, it would as likely unify that movement as divide them. And I think at the end of the day, he's not going to be the part of the baby that's sacrificed if they try to split it that fine. If there is a climb down, and again, I think you'd have to consider it a less than even proposition, I don't think it answers any questions about Turkey's long-term soul. How do you wind down Ergenekon after you've started this thing? Where does this go? What does it say about the future of reform after having seen the Prime Minister's recent track record? I asked people, do you believe he can learn? And the answer was no. That's a strong judgment, but it's a widely shared one. And can we? A lot of people will tell you today, now that the court has ruled on the headscarf, it's over. That issue's behind us. I wonder. I mean, this is one that's been around as long as I've been dealing with Turkey, which is over a decade now. And the notion that it simply goes away as a result of this chain of events seems a little surprising for me. In any case, I think this is one of those subjects where maybe the best approach is to get into Q&A and see where it leads us. Thank you for the opportunity to be here again.
Thank you. And actually, it was a fascinating and very comprehensive review based on your visit. Now, changing the format before I open up the Q&A, let me ask you a question. You avoided the words deal and compromise, but you did talk about MAD, the mutual assured destruction. Now, if there is going to be a deal that's not a deal, a compromise that's not a compromise, in which both sides wish to avoid the meltdown, somebody will have to put it together, given the confrontations, growing confrontation and escalation. I cannot see Gül doing it for obvious reasons. You know, Hilmi Özkök is being attacked by people for coming out. If there is going to be deal or compromise, who's going to put it together?
Beats me. It's a short answer. And as I've thought about this, I mean, clearly it's very difficult for any of the principals to meet in public without precipitating all kinds of speculation as to what's going on. We've seen that happen already. Are there trusted intermediaries? I have no idea. Probably not, would be my guess. Are they capable of figuring out what each would have to do on their own without there being an explicit conversation? Maybe. This is Turkey, after all. Here's the alternative. The alternative is they all go over the cliff together. And so under those circumstances, in my experience, often people will find a way to avoid that. You know, again, will it resolve anything other than the current very adverse dynamics in terms of Turkey's economy, in terms of confidence in Turkey's democracy, in terms of the futures of the people involved? I have no idea. But I don't want you to hear that I expect this to happen. Again, I think it's a less than 50-50 chance. But I think that increasingly people's thinking is moving in that direction in Turkey today.
A lot of expertise in this room, so I'll open it up. We've got plenty of time for questions. Ümit Engisoy goes first, and please put up your hand for other questions. Please.
This was great, eye-opening, and thank you, Bülent, for this. Is it just two options, a deal or a mutually assured destruction? And if just two options, could you elaborate a little bit on MAD?
Well, I mean, Diplomats don't like two options. we're fond of gray. And I think the answer to your question is there's not just two options, and there's a lot of, there's probably a broad spectrum, a continuum of solutions. But mutually assured destruction would mean that certain people would be out of politics, and certain people might be in jail, and certain people might be under investigation for a long time with all the uncertainties that that creates. And mutually assured destruction means that the economy's in free fall, for starters. And I think when responsible people look down the abyss at the realities here, a rational person would conclude there's got to be a better way than the way this is moving. That's really all I mean. And I haven't thought this through in a systematic way, but that's my impression.
Question, comment? Ali Aslan.
Pushing the button. It's maybe my mutually assured destruction of it. There's a lot of discussion about the American response and whether it's appropriate. And, it breaks pretty much along the lines that you'd expect in terms of what you think about it. I think the genius of the American approach until fairly recently has been that it's convinced everybody that we're supporting their adversaries. The secularists thought we're supporting AKP, the AKP thought we're supporting the secularists. Again, speaking in very simplistic terms. I think that the statements that Condoleezza Rice and Matt Braza made over the past couple of weeks have clarified the American position and have tended to make people in Turkey understand more clearly that the United States, really, no kidding, does not want to see a coup take place in Turkey and does not want to see Turkey gain the image of a failed democracy. Those are my words. They're not the words that have been used by U.S. government spokesmen. But I sense that that's essentially the logic behind what they've said. And I think that sort of on the margins, those kinds of statements have helped some of the actors that I've described understand better that closure of the party would have consequences on the U.S.-Turkish relationship, at least in terms of tone and in terms of the way the United States would have to describe it. And, you know, depending on whether you care about those sort of things, that may or may not affect how the situation plays out. In terms of the question of this simply being due process, one does hear that both here and in Turkey, that this is simply democracies doing what democracies do. Courts hear cases, courts make decisions, etc. Personal view, as one who heard similar descriptions once upon a time when I was a Soviet specialist, court systems have their own internal logic. And, the notion that just because it's in the court, it's due process, or it meets Western standards of integrity or impartiality or justice is by no means certain. I guess I'll stop there.
I'll just add something to it, if I may. If you look at the commentary we put out, one thing is notable by its omission, which is the external factor. Unlike the crisis in 1997, when every word that was uttered in Washington was front page news, the things that are being said here or not said here is being analyzed less. Same thing with the EU reaction. It's like Turkey's drawn in on itself. Those who don't care, as you said, about the external reaction would perhaps welcome more statements so that they could use it. And, I get the impression from Tayyip Erdogan and his people that they're not as interested in trying to get international support through visits to Washington, which have simply not taken place during the past month as this crisis has evolved. Leads me to the conclusion that, Turkey's drawn in on itself. This fight is going to be resolved within Turkey's borders, and the external actors are going to react to it rather than shape it.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think that, and I consciously use the words on the margins, because I think that's where the impact of American or European or other comment has been and is going to be. And I think, you know, you could also make the mistake of being too loud and too indignant about some of this stuff and probably do damage to the process. And I think we're slowly moving towards getting it more or less right.
You had mentioned the reaction of the United States. What have we seen thus far as reactions from the EU? And secondly, given what's been happening, how far back has this set EU accession for Turkey?
Well, it's a good question, because I was in fact traveling with a group that was about 50% EU and 50% American, and it was very, very clear from the standpoint of my European colleagues that, as one of them put it, you know, if Turks think that the fact that Turkey is run by a party like AKP with Recep Tayyip Erdogan at the head gives us pause and makes us question Turkey's democratic Western credentials, is wrong. What would make us really question Turkey's Western democratic credentials is if he were no longer the Prime Minister of Turkey as a function of this kind of a process. And they took every opportunity that they could to make that point. As Bulent suggested, I think, you know, whether or not that had any impact whatsoever on the Turkish audience is debatable, questionable, because, you know, for 3 years or so, in my view, Europe has been giving Turkey consistently discouraging indicators, which have largely removed them from being a factor in the Turkish internal political debate. We're not quite in that same category, but we have our own baggage to carry. And I think the bottom line is exactly the point that Bulent just made. To kind of reverse field, there is a sense, and you can see it in some of the recent editorial comment in Europe, that this crisis has in some ways refocused the Europeans on the fact that better to have a Turkey with that is engaged with Europe in a constructive way, however long it takes to get there, than to have a Turkey which has concluded there is no European option and therefore draws its own conclusions and could move down an authoritarian and violent path.
The Europeans you were traveling with, and editorial opinion such as it is so far, unless I've missed something, there's been very little supportive comment from EU capitals, maybe a few commissioners in Brussels, but otherwise I haven't seen any of the EU governments taking a position on what's going on in Turkey. And I wonder to what extent this registers with the AKP and its leadership, and how they react to the absence of that. They're being treated like an offstage presence.
I think actually the Europeans have been as clear as they dare, kind of across the board, in conveying the message that this would have a chilling effect on prospects for Turkey's EU candidacy, a candidacy which, it must be said, was kind of stalled anyway. So, you know, again, what the impact of that is debatable. The British in particular, at the foreign minister level and publicly on his last visit to Turkey, couldn't have been much clearer about their view of this. The others have been less so and have allowed the Commission, I think, to speak for them to some extent. But even among those who are not friendly to the EU, even among those who are the firmest believers in Turkey's EU vocation, I find no dispute anywhere in the country that a closure of the party would be a de facto end to the experiment. They might not suspend Turkey formally. They would probably find ways of keeping the process formally open. But the notion that a Turkey where something like this has just occurred is a viable candidate is sort of the null set for most Europeans. It would, among other things, simply put them in violation of the Copenhagen criteria, which were the basis of their candidacy in the first place.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Ambassador, thanks very much. I just have a few remarks. I just came back from Turkey as well, and maybe I may add to what you said on the legal process. I have heard from some experts that the court, the Constitutional Court, may actually give the verdict of 2AKP as the center of non-secular activities, but choose not to shut down the party or ban Tayyip Erdogan, which may be equally handed and give a guarantee and maybe a sigh of relief to the secular circles and at the same time. Now, this is one of the options. An additional point might be the former chief prosecutor, Sabih Kanadoğlu, who spoke last week, and he's sort of the guru of all these legal crises these days, that he left the door open saying that the Prime Minister Erdogan may actually become a candidate on an independent ballot, just like previous times. So it looks like there's a little bit of a tango going on the legal scene, and I'll let you interpret that. What I want to ask personally is that you said that Turkey might need some time to play this out, and it might take a while to get there. My question is, the longer it gets, the bigger problem it becomes, the Ergenekon case, in terms of its legitimacy, the people in jail, in terms of habeas corpus and how you bring them to the court. And it looks like the bureaucracy in Ankara has practically stopped. They're not signing any papers. They're not doing anything. I would see that becoming a problem on the economic front rather than the stock market, which is doing actually well in regards to the Western markets. Would you comment?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, at a certain point, there are sort of diminishing returns or accelerating costs, to look at it another way, of delay. I don't think it can go on forever. I think that this is going to. I mean, the court president, I think, has said this would be done within 6 weeks, and at least one of the weeks is gone. So I think it takes you to the middle or the third week of August. I would expect certainly in August that there's going to be a decision by the court, and that if there is an implicit or other solution to this problem, which involves trade-offs of various sorts, the intervening period would be used to put this together. Some of the solutions that you've talked about certainly are all over the place, and I think go to Umit's question of what is between the two stark extremes. One elegant solution, which I've heard, stems from the fact that you can convict a court with one vote. You can convict someone with or a party with one vote, but you can punish it with only two. And if there's a split decision of one vote, then you could have it both ways. Party's guilty, but it doesn't get punished. Stranger things have happened. We'll just have to see.
You know, one word of caution. Kanadoğlu may be saying this now, but he was saying the very exact opposite just a few weeks ago. Mm-hmm. And also, now that it's been touched on, I just want to say a few words about the economy. The stock market, after being in the 50,000s, is now in the 30,000. Sure, I mean, it's people are still making money. But, again, there are people in this room who follow this much more closely, but the amount of short-term funds, hot money, if you like, that's been going into Turkey has come down. That may be because of the global crisis rather than what's going on inside Turkey. But for some time now, I've been watching to see when the economic recovery program was going to be affected, either by people's evaluations of the impact of the domestic crisis, or by the unwillingness of the government, and specifically the Minister for the Economy, to take unpopular decisions because of the JDP's desire to stay on the good books of the people. And frankly, I think we've reached that point where there is an impact on the economy. The question is how big an impact and how much, although people may have discounted the possibility of party closure, nonetheless, reading some of the stuff that the investors are writing, they're becoming more conscious of the implications of the decision than before. And one final note, Sinan Aygün, the head of the Ankara Chamber of Commerce, was picked up in the sweep, although he's since been released. And if you look at the stuff, the allegedly leaked stuff that's out there, you know, bringing an economic crisis or engendering or stimulating or promoting, provoking an economic crisis was very much part of the plot, such as we understand it. So this bears watching.
Yeah, on the economy, I would also caution against taking it face value statements like I saw the other day, that Turkey's the comeback kid. Investment houses that over the past 4 or 5 years have dumped a lot of money into Turkey would like to get that back. And so I suspect there's a certain amount of whistling past the graveyard going on here.
How do you see the regional implications of this, Iraq in particular, but beyond that?
Well, I mean, the thrust of this visit that I was on with the Atlantic Council was to talk about Turkey's role in the Middle East, which is obviously expanded in recent years, and has some very interesting features. And the issue that we were very interested in is, you know, whether or not this is a function of the current government or objective circumstances, and would there be any effect if Turkey weren't being ruled by the same people. And the answer that I think we came away with was that, you know, Turkey would have to be a more active player in the region today because of things that we Americans have done, because of the Iranian role, because of the weakness of certain actors in any case, and they'd pay a price if they weren't, because events would eventually come to their own door. But that the sort of enthusiasm, the personality factor, the sort of comfort level that the current team has displayed as it's sought to deal with some of these issues may very well be missing. And, you know, again, on the margins, that's the sort of thing that can make a difference in how effective policies are or are not. It's trying to answer a hypothetical question, but that's sort of where we came out.
You know, the interplay of the domestic crisis in Turkey and regional politics is fascinating. You know, Erdogan was in Iraq, where he had important meetings. Turkish attitude towards a possible strike, or if not a strike, you know, hardening of the embargo against Iran is an issue that will come up. Turkey's relations with the Caucasus, particularly Armenia, with the Armenian foreign minister in town, is an issue. The ongoing Cyprus talks. And, you know, my view is that at a time when Turkey is focusing on its domestic crisis, the answers to the questions that you and your team were asking were simply put off, because they are not in a position to say how things will look 3 months, 6 months, 9 months down the road, because there are other people might be sitting in those chairs, or the people who are there may still be preoccupied with those questions. So, you know, in terms of Turkish foreign policy and its, you know, outlook over the next few months, I think a watching brief might be better than trying to make some guesses as to where it's going to go. Sam?
Well, Bulent will have his own views on this, and I'd like to hear them. But, I mean, that I think is precisely what's going to be tested in the next 6 months. It's my own view that regardless of what happens, chances of a general election between now and next spring are reasonably high. So we'll see. In a very concrete way, your question is really two questions. One is: are the existing parties capable of regenerating themselves to the point that they can pose a serious challenge to AKP's hegemony? And if you go by recent history or current polls, the answer looks to be no. The other part of the question is: can a new party be established that can take back some of the center-right, non-religiously motivated voters that AKP robbed from parties like ANAP and DYP in 2002 and 2007? And that remains to be seen. You know, the big question is whether the quality of this crisis and the gap that could be created if AKP is closed will create enough space for politicians to fill that space. Is something that they will test, and several of them are positioning themselves to find out.
I think, you know, Sam and I have talked about this before, but more than the ability of people with proven failures on the track, like Bakhchali and Baikal. I think it will really depend on what happens within AK. I mean, they've got a proven track record, as I went into that in my introduction, and it's worth remembering that they moved into the void after 97 by creating this party, which split off from Virtue. They set up the party in August 2001 and then defeated the established parties very decisively in 2002. Now, if the party is closed, or even if it's not, and but has had to go through a major test, it depends whether Tayyip Erdogan will be able to control his party as completely as it does now. Now, there are certain questions that I think we need to raise, although we cannot answer them. The reported differences with Abdullah Gül, certainly. Who may be the caretaker in the event that that he's banned from politics and the party continues and he's unable, for whatever reason, to come back in by-elections is another issue. Now, he's talking about how you cannot get off the train. Now, he himself had got off the Virtue train in 2001. So there may be people who may get off this train, although they haven't done so far. I cannot see it, but it's entirely possible. And we'll have to see whether Şener has any appeal to the AK Party, to the JDP. He only resigned just a couple of days ago. He went to the Central Committee, of which he was still a member, and resigned. And now he's setting up this new movement, and we'll see where it goes. But it will depend much more on AK's ability to hang together, as it were, to use the old expression, than on the ability of their opponents, who simply cannot get any traction. I cannot see Baykal getting any traction because, you know, we got the track record out there. And imagine if Alparslan Türkeş, with his charisma, whether one liked him or not, was at the head of the NAP at this moment instead of the rather colorless leader that they have now. Next, could I see if there's anybody else, and I will follow up. Daniel
Just
Gerber.
To follow on this question. And then the Kurdish question on that, too, because so many Kurds followed AKP because of its EU policies. Is that enough to keep them on board, or do they lose ground as well?
Yeah, I suspect that, we've got people that I would call liberals in this room. Maybe some of them will want to step up and comment. But I would guess that he will lose some of them, maybe a lot of them. And, you know, weighed against a Turkish population of 75 million, I'm not sure that anybody would notice. Where they are important is in terms of their influence in the media, in the intellectual world, in sort of defining the terms of reference for the next debate. And so that could be significant as you get into the an election. But I'm not sure if it's going to be possible to persuade people, you know, through newsprint, not to vote for AKP the next time around. We'll see. But I do think that events since July have probably permanently changed the nature of Erdogan's relationship with that segment of the Turkish political spectrum. The second question was the Kurds. I mean, and therefore, and importantly, where does AKP pick up votes next time? They pick them up in the Kurdish areas, and it's probably not accidental that he's moving steadfastly ahead in the middle of all this crisis to spend $15 billion in the Kurdish areas to improve the quality of their lives. I think AKP is making a big bet, and I think it's been their top priority since last July to extend their political clout decisively into the traditional DTP Kurdish vote, and we'll just have to see how that. I mean, obviously, when it happens is important.
He may also be, Erdogan may also be hoping to benefit from the closure of the DTP. And there's a little bit of hypocrisy involved here, that here he is complaining about the undemocratic nature of the closing down of his party, but he hasn't said a word about the closing down of the DTP, which is also being considered by the Constitutional Court. And having wanted to win the areas that were previously won by the DTP, he may be cynically hoping to pick up additional support in the Kurdish areas. And I'm not sure it's going to work, because there's a great deal of disillusionment there because of his willingness to sanction operations beyond Turkey's borders, his unwillingness to proceed with some of the reforms that were previously talked about. And I'm not sure that it's a given that he's going to get as much support or increase it in the next elections.
I agree with that. And in terms of his calculus, I mean, it reinforces my point about common political culture. I mean, he's not approaching this differently than a classic Turkish politician would.
Yeah. I think another way of putting the question is, would they be doing the things you're talking about now if they weren't distracted by this crisis? I was in the street and I saw somebody wearing a button that said, "Let us work." And the notion is, nobody can get anything done when this is going on. If you listened to Minister Şimşek when he was through here, 4 months ago? He was talking about doing all the things that you would describe as necessary, and was very serious and convincing about it. I don't know whether they would be doing it or not if, in fact, they were able to give it full attention, and I don't know whether they will if they win the next election as well. I got to say, I think that in the economy, as in the realm of some of the political reforms that they said were a priority, I haven't sensed in the period since July the kind of passion or commitment to get them done that I would have liked to. And I agree with you fully and I've been saying for a long time that at some point the piper is going to come calling, and they will pay the price for the delays that they've allowed to occur.
Yeah. I'll take Carol McDelevitz and then we'll go with Ahu Özyurt in a second. But if I may, Carol, just a quick observation on this issue. You know, although the macroeconomic figures look good for a long time, at the microeconomic level, people were complaining about the economy all the time. It was anecdotal, but everybody complained. And yet, you had a situation in July 2007 in which the ruling party did not have to fight the elections on the economy. It fought it on the presidential elections and whether they should be given another mandate to oppose those who were opposing them. Now, early elections, if they're fought after the party's closed, again, would not be fought on the economy, although it should be for all the reasons that you mentioned. So from Erdogan's point of view, it may be a blessing in disguise, just as it was last year, that there are other issues which are going to be to the fore instead of the economy. Carol McDelevitz, and then Ahu Özyurt. Again.
Thank you. According to one scenario of the thousands that are being written nowadays, if Erdogan is banned, his parliamentary immunity is automatically lifted, and he becomes vulnerable to possible prosecution for corruption or other crimes, real or unreal. Who then, if that scenario is a plausible one, who then in the AK scene do you see coming forward to take over or to be the front man of a revised, refashioned AK? So that's one question. The second question, I think, is for Bülent, and maybe it's just a language one. In your long-term scenario, you talked about a contest between unfettered democracy and counter-revolution against Kemalism. Who's the force of unfettered democracy in Turkey?
I didn't say that. What I said is that that's how it would be portrayed, not by me, but by those. I'd be happy to read you exactly how I put it. Now, there's no such thing as unfettered democracy in this world, but it would be described as, again, if you look at the way that AK, the JDP, fought the last elections, it was precisely on those terms. Said, you know, our democracy is being curbed, curtailed, fettered, and we need to fight against that. And he would use the same kind of language. I stand by the way I put it. It's a matter of terminology, and the polarization that I was referring to is precisely what's getting us into this area that, you know, you're focusing on, in which the rhetoric is heating up. People are describing it as between good and evil. All you have to do is look at some of our favorite columnists and the way that they've chosen to be on one side of the camp or the other. And I'm not sure how this is going to be unwound once the decision is made. If anything, it could get worse before it gets better. And I'll take a crack at the first part of the question, too, before I kick it to Mark. Look, Tayyip Erdogan is not just primus inter pares. He is head and shoulders over everybody else, not just in his own party, but as I said, on the Turkish political firmament. Whoever goes into those shoes will have very big shoes to fill. Now, his enemies know that. So just closing the party but allowing it to continue would almost ensure that, you know, he comes back stronger. So ideally, if you want both his party and him out of the way, you ban the party, you ban him, and then whoever comes in simply will not do as good a job. Now, the names that have been bandied about, you're as familiar with as I am. I honestly cannot see Ali Babacan doing the job. I just don't think he's up to it. I'm not sure that Tayyip Erdogan wants him to take over for all sorts of reasons that I won't get into. I think he would want somebody that he would totally trust, and that may be Mehmet Ali Şahin or Nazım Ekren or somebody else who would be a stand-in in the, if you like, the Turgut Özal, Yıldırım Akbulut model, which didn't quite work out for Turgut Özal, may in the case of Tayyip Erdogan. But, you know, Tayyip Erdogan's control of his party is even stronger than it was in the heyday of Turgut Özal, and that's saying something.
Yeah, I would, I guess, only add, listening to Bülent, I agree with everything he said, basically, but I mean, what would follow is chaos, basically, as they tried to figure out what to do. And I'm not sure that there is a crisp, clear successor. And what that would mean is that the world would be watching Turkey try to figure out where it goes from that point. It wouldn't be pretty. The markets would react. And I suspect that you'd also see fairly strong reactions from editorial opinion around the world and in varying degrees of official opinion. You would be seeing Turkish democracy struggling and without any clear signposts as to where to go next or how to get out of it. That's one of the reasons that I am skeptical that a solution that tries to take out Erdogan but spare the party is a viable solution in the long term.
Okay. We may have time for one more question after that.
I'm not going to take too much time. This is just an addition to what Carol said and you just said, and I just wanted to clarify, if you see Şener's movement as a real alternative, a real different movement, or maybe just a temporary position to you know, if the party is shut down, some place for the MPs and people in the party to look into as a temporary post, like a Cinder or Demirel position?
Well, remains to be seen. I mean, I keep on reading about, for example, Tunay Bekleric preparing his party for those who may be banned, which I simply cannot take seriously. I cannot take Bekleric or his party seriously, and yet I keep on reading that this is the alternative that that people are looking at. Now, Şener, there's been a very strange phase that we lived through. Şener said that he would not go into the elections, so he didn't run in Sivas, but he stayed on as part of the Central Committee. And he only resigned from it 2 days ago, although his differences with Tayyip Erdogan and with the party were pretty well known to everybody, including to Erdogan and those within the party. He set up a new movement. I've looked at the list of those who might be with him. Frankly, I couldn't recognize any of them. So it would have to be Şener himself. And although I know and like Mr. Şener, and I've talked to him extensively, I'm not sure that he has the kind of charisma to actually compete with Tayyip Erdogan. His reputation as an honest, decent man. He has a track record within the party, as well as his Islamist predecessors. That will give him some degree of credibility. But we'll have to see whether he can actually develop into the credible alternative. But then again, you know, Tayyip Erdogan has found the formula. Whether one likes him or not, he is a very good speaker. He dominates the crowds. He dominates the agenda. He fills the pad. I mean, just looking at him with Sarkozy, there he was, you know. He didn't even want to go to the meeting, and he was dominating the proceedings as he invariably does. And he's grown into the job, and whoever challenges him, we'll have to follow, I mean, I don't know whether you would agree with this, the Tayyip Erdogan model. You know, I think he set up a mold for the Turkish leader that others will have to follow And I'm not sure that there is anybody out there who can do it at this particular moment. Any more questions? Otherwise, we'll wind it up. Well, as there are no more questions, thank you all for coming, and I'd like to thank Ambassador Paris for joining us today.